Representative Vasquez, Representative Liskin, and Representative Ewing. First bill we're going to be hearing today be House Bill 160. Yes, committee substitute for House Bill 546. At this time, it's a piece of legislation pertains to harassment of hunters and fishermen. Bill Heim isn't here.
Ed Heim isn't here.
Or Ed, I mean. We have anyone else here? Yes, okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Ruth Andrews from Sportsman's Council would like to comment on this legislation.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir?
Before you take testimony, I just want to know, is this the same draft committee substitute that we were working with last time, or have there been changes?
As you look at the excerpt, Peter, the orange will indicate changed language, the blue is new language that has been added to address the questions that Gail Horesky from the AG's office raised on the legislation we heard last time, which was a CS. So this is in fact a new draft CS.
Okay, and you have changed the language in yellow and you added the language in blue, and am I to understand that nothing has been deleted, or has something also been deleted from the last committee substitute?
In the orange section, there has been a deletion. If you'll read the memo, the words knowingly interfere were dropped, and the words were replaced with intentionally obstruct or hinder. Now, it's my understanding, after talking with Ed Hine, he's been working with the AG's office on this language, and the main concern at the last meeting was that people who were incidentally enjoying the out-of-doors could be cited if the bill had passed in a previous form. And if you will look down on section D, subsection D, on line 23, you'll see the wording, this section does not apply to obstruction or hindrance that is incidental to the lawful use of public or private land or water.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rip Andrews. I do represent the Alaska Outdoor Council, and my comments today will be brief. The council is in favor of the committee substitute for House Bill 546. We testified in favor of this bill last year, and as you know the history of the bill, it did pass the legislature and was vetoed by the governor on the advice of the Attorney General that there were problems with the enforcement. It does appear, and I am advised that the changes that have been made will probably take care of the problems of enforcement. I would like to just add on line 19, a peace officer who reasonably believes that a person has violated, you may want to amend this to insert the wording or intends to violate this section. Line 21, the officer may arrest, you may want to include may cite or arrest. As a peace officer, enforcement officer in Alaska for 23 years, I never arrested anybody, but I sure cite a lot of people. And there is a difference, of course. And in a misdemeanor case, it's usually the case where you cite, not arrest.
If I could go back, for May, to the line 19, the peace officer who reasonably believes that a person...
Mr. Chairman, line 19 and 920, starting with a peace officer who reasonably believes that a person has violated or intends to violate this section.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay,
my only question would be, and I don't have the legal expertise or anything else on this, but it would be kind of hard to convict someone under intent.
That's right.
Intent is always difficult, but if you've got a group of people and one of them's got a big bullhorn and he's about to do something with that bullhorn, that's intent to me. And I think a judge or a magistrate, at least in Palmer, will hold it up.
I'm just to follow up on that. I would think that in some of the things that have been discussed and have gone on in the other states where a person went out with recorders, things of that nature, set them up out in the woods and was getting ready to detract the game or try to get the game from that area during hunting season, that would be, and they have done nothing to violate anything, but the intent is certainly there.
Mr. Chairman, Thank you,
Representative Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would seem to me that if we put intend or intends under violated under line 20, that it would seem like it would be covered under line 11 and 12, where a person may not perform an act with intent to obstruct. Wouldn't the intention already be in the law if it was left on the above sentence, and then there would be no reason to have to put it down below, because the intention would already be proved essentially up above, and then he could go ahead and arrest that person?
I apologize to the committee. Ed Hine had said that he would be here to answer those type of questions, but let me paraphrase, if I can, what he has told me. This subsection, if you look at some of the language from seven other states that he looked at and the research he did since the last meeting, is put here so that a peace officer, enforcement officer, when he sees a situation developing that may turn violent or may present a problem, this gives him the authority to intervene before that situation escalates. And if you look, it says they may order the person to desist, in other words, don't do this, or leave, and then further it says it may cite or arrest. So this is what you might term preventive maintenance, and that's the reason it's there for interviewing.
I know, but so you're saying that you're recommending that we put or intends in on 128?
If you don't have or intends in there, that's a good point that Rupe has brought up. It doesn't allow the officer, if he obviously sees a situation developing, to do anything until there has been a confrontation. And in that line of thinking, it doesn't allow him to really prevent a situation. And I think the intends to violate, it'd have to be something very obvious to be upheld in a court of law, but at the same time, it may not get that far. He may simply say, don't go up there with your bullhorns and your strobe lights, because if you do, you're beside it. And I think that's the idea of this language, and I would draw your attention to the statutes in other states, and I think that's why they've included those.
So do I understand then that it's your feeling that the language, or that you've been advised by counsel, that if a person is out there doing something which effectively obstructs the lawful use of another person of public land, and that person, I guess what, let me rephrase, what disturbs me and has disturbed me all along and worries me here is that I think what's been intended here on section D, line 23, says this section does not apply to obstruction or hindrance that is incidental to the lawful use of public or private land or water, which clearly is intended to address at least my concern, and I think that of some others, as to whether a lawful use of public land which incidentally obstructs, let's say, hunting for the sake of argument, could be prosecuted under this chapter. And I'm just not sure we've gone far enough. I don't know. I don't have the solution. It just seems to me that if a person is out there having a loud, I don't know, I can't even think of an example, but the easy example would be if you're out there doing something that's noisy and somebody is coming along to hunt and you fail to stop, it becomes a question of the courts. Well, did they fail to stop because they were trying to impede the use of the public land, or did they fail to stop because they resented the attitude of the hunter who came by and said, gee, couldn't you turn down your radio? I think that's one of the reasons why the bill was not approved before and why it won't be again. And I, rather than continuing with that comment, would sure like it if we could find some way to make it more clear, but insofar as I don't think it's possible to make it more clear, I question whether this bill will work.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing you may not have noticed, Representative Gall, was under subsection A of section 1. The language states that a person may not perform an act with intent to obstruct or hinder hunting, fishing, or trapping. Prior to that, it was intentionally interfere with a person who is hunting, fishing, or trapping. This, again, is to go a step further, as you suggested. Until a person is, in fact, hunting, fishing, or trapping, and engaged lawfully in that activity, he can't be considered obstructive or hindered.
Right. I did notice that, and that certainly is an improvement and does respond to the questions earlier. I've discussed this at so much length, I'm not going to burden you with it again. I regret to say, because I do think that certainly a person engaging in hunting, fishing, and trapping has a right to be protected under the law from undue interference. I guess I'm maybe drawing the line between interference and obstruction. If someone is is interfering with the activity, well, again, it becomes semantics. I'm not able to deal with the problem. I appreciate your letting me comment.
Luke, you have something?
I don't have any further comment, Mr. Chairman, except that on line 20, instead of saying violated or intends to violate, perhaps a little better wording might be has violated or demonstrates an intent to violate. That might clear it up a little bit more.
Or demonstrates what?
Demonstrates an intent. Does that make it?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lesko.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see we have Gail Horesky here from the Department of Law here. Maybe Gail could put some input into
right.
this. Because we go getting into intents and intends, we're into real trouble here.
Representative Lesko, what we're going to have, we're going to have Ed Heim testify. And then we'll have Gail testify, and she may be able to correct us on any legal problems we may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My only question was, and I think the bill is getting nearer to what I had some concerns about, too, to mention, but you could be carrying on two legal activities. Say on a lake that would be in direct opposites to each other, and I'm thinking of Representative Mueling wants to go fishing, and I want to enter a motorboat race. How would this bill here address that? Would fishing have precedence, or would they both be equal, or?
We'll ask Ed to come. Ed Hine come up and to testify here, and it's a good question.
Lawful use.
Watch out, though.
Lawful use.
Governor.
Indeed. Both of you got a good comment.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ed.
If you give your
Hine.
Name.
I'm an attorney with Legislative Affairs, and I'm a drafting attorney. I take it you have before you the draft resources CS.
Right.
Okay. I should presume that at this point it would be appropriate to just go over the changes that were made. And I should point out right off that there are still some issues that need to be resolved, even with this draft. And I may refer you to Gail Horesky for some of the questions, and some of them are more of a, in nature of a policy problem than a legal one. Okay, getting to the substance of the changes made by this proposed CS, and comparing it with the bill that's before the committee. Essentially what has been done here is we've deleted the only changes are made in the first half of section one of the bill, from lines, page one, lines 10 through lines 20. And these two subsections were deleted, and we have new subsections in their place. Subsection A is substantially shorter for several reasons, and we've taken quite a different approach here. The existing bill, first of all, talks, and we discussed this at the last meeting, I believe, talks in terms of interference. Instead of using that word, which the governor had suggested was too vague, we're using the term obstruction or hindrance. Admittedly, there's not a whole lot of difference, but we're getting a little bit more precise, I think, in terms of what we're talking about. I used reference to Webster's Dictionary to get a little different shades of meaning. And no matter what term you use, I think unless you're going to spell out precisely the specific acts that you want to prohibit, you're going to be stuck with some general term that covers all of them, and there's always going to be some degree of vagueness. In any event, I think it's a little bit of an improvement to go with these terms. Although I should point out, as I have in this memo, that seven other states that have similar laws all use the term interfere or interference. None of them define the term. I spoke with attorneys from a couple of the states who were involved either in drafting the bill or reviewing it for their governor's office. None of them suggested that, in fact, they all stated that there had been no questions raised about the vagueness of it or First Amendment problems. That's not to say that they can't be argued legitimately, but none of them saw it as a problem in their laws. Now, another change in this same subsection here is that we're changing the approach. Instead of saying we're interfering with a person who does such and such or who is doing such and such, we're saying you can't obstruct or hinder the activity, that is, the hunting, fishing, or trapping. This takes out, I think, a little bit more of the vagueness as to what we're talking about. Thirdly, what I thought was a confusing aspect of the bill as it is now is that when you read subsection A of the bill, it says that a person may not knowingly interfere, and that says with the intent of hindering or preventing. Now, I read that as being almost two separate states of mind that a person has to have and that a prosecutor would have to prove. So what I've done here in this draft substitute is to say simply that a person may not perform an act with the intent to obstruct or hinder hunting, fishing, trapping, engaged in lawfully by another person. I think this makes it clear that what we're talking about here is a specific intent crime, that the prosecutor has to show that no matter what act was performed, if there was, in doing that act, the intent to obstruct or hinder, presumably even if the person was not successful, then that would fit the definition of crime, and that's what the prosecutor would have to establish. I would bring to your attention that we've narrowed down the list considerably. It looks a lot shorter because now we're just saying hunting, fishing, and trapping. This includes all kinds, including commercial fishing and any kind of hunting, trapping, and so on. Now, it wasn't clear to me after listening to the discussion at the last meeting in which this was discussed whether it was the committee's intent to include commercial fishing in the... There was some discussion about it, and I wasn't being presumptuous in including it, and I do bring it to your attention. As I understood the problem, the reason that commercial fishing was not included in the bill was because it was thought that traditional forms of competition, methods of competition among commercial fishermen were such that they didn't want... They more or less figured that this was fair play or a sporting activity and didn't want that to be covered under the statute. At least that's how I understood what you were saying. If it's a concern, if you want to cover commercial fishing, I think this bill will protect those sorts of competitive methods, if you will, because what we have here is a new subsection D, and where we say that if this interference or if this obstruction or hindrance is incidental to the lawful use of public or private land and water, is not covered. In other words, if the main purpose that the person is out there for is a lawful purpose, whether it be other hunters or fishers or campers or hikers or whatever, or if it's on the water, boaters, then and what they do interferes with what some other lawful user is doing, it's too bad. If it's simply something that's unavoidable or simply something that, even if they know in advance that, yeah, this is likely to happen, what this does is instead of saying we have an absolute preference here for these sports users and for hunters and fishermen, we're saying we recognize in this bill that all legal or lawful uses of the land and the water are legitimate, and what we're aiming this at are the people who are going out there specifically with the purpose of hindering these people who are conducting lawful activities. In addition, I think another improvement, we tried to clarify what is meant by lawfully. That is, being lawfully engaged in hunting, fishing, and trapping. Now, this has two aspects. One is the person licensed to do the activity? The second is he doing it in a place where it's lawful to do it? And there you come into your questions of whether the person is on private land or public land or native land versus federal land or state land and so on. In subsection B, we have said that lawfully means in accordance with essentially state and federal fish and game laws. In addition, if the activity is being conducted on private land, we're saying that it has to be done with the permission of the landowner. This is a provision that was taken essentially from the Nevada statute. Do you have copies of the other states' statutes?
They are in the packet.
The Nevada statute and some of the other statutes as well have similar provisions. So this language was adapted from that concept, and I guess that's all I have to say about that. The next subsection, C, also, this was taken from the Arizona provision. Other states have similar provisions. This, I think, was the most conservative of them. The concept in subsection C is that you want to give the peace officer, enforcement officer, some discretion to take action or to stop a person even if he hasn't seen the activity occurring. Some of the other states have provisions which would, I think, allow the enforcement officer to take action before any offense has occurred.
If I may, at this time, while we're on section C, when Roop was up, he offered an amendment or suggested an amendment to this committee, and that would be on line 20, and after the word violated, he had some language to begin with that said, after that said, or intends to violate, and then after rethinking that, came up with a different language that would say, after violated, would say, demonstrates an intent to violate. And I'd like to have you comment on that, plus on line 21, saying that the officer may cite or arrest the person upon refusal to desist and leave. On the 21, I wouldn't see any problem with putting a cite or arrest. I believe that. Yeah, I'd like to have you comment on the on line 20, though, the demonstrates the intent to violate.
Mr. Chairman, I have to say that even the language in here that I put in here, this is taken, I think, verbatim from the Arizona statute. I'm not totally satisfied with the language that I borrowed from them. And I think Gail will address this question, too. There's a question of what information must an officer have before he can make an arrest constitutionally. But in addition, I think that the amendments that you're talking about lead further along toward the concept of acting with less and less information. And, you know, to some extent it's a policy question. It's also a legal question. As I said, I chose this because this was the most conservative. That is, under this language, the peace officer at least has to believe or have some reasonable grounds for believing that a violation has already been committed, as opposed to is going to be committed. And it seems to me that whenever you get into what we call inchoate crimes, crimes that have not been committed yet, or at least the final acts haven't been committed yet, you're getting into more and more dangerous ground as far as constitutional limitations are concerned. I'm not saying you can't regulate that conduct, but I think that the concerns of the law and of the Constitution will be to make certain that we're not just taking a peace officer's suspicions. Okay, now, other states have used language closer to what you're suggesting has been amended here. Let's see if I can point out specific. There's only seven statutes here. If you look at the Illinois statute, if you have it in front of you, subsection 3, or section 3, it's right in the middle of the Illinois statute, says that any person who knowingly performs any of the following acts is guilty of a Class B misdemeanor. Then it goes on to say, fails to obey the order of a police officer, a peace officer, to desist from conduct in violation of the previous section. If the officer observes such conduct or has reasonable grounds to believe that the person has engaged in such conduct that day, or that the person plans or intends to engage in such conduct that day on a specific premises. Louisiana, I believe, has similar language. Yes, Louisiana, at the very bottom of there, it says, it shall be unlawful for any person to continue any conduct in violation of their main statute when ordered to desist by an enforcement officer who has observed such conduct or who has reasonable grounds to believe that the person has engaged in such conduct on that day or plans or intends to engage in such conduct that day on a specific property. It's very similar. And other states are somewhere in between.
Yeah. In line with both of those states, in Louisiana and Illinois, then the language saying demonstrates an intent to violate would be kind of along the same lines as what they're talking about. Would it not?
Mr. Chairman, it does, except that the reasonable grounds to believe would apply to each of those in this case. Now, I'm not certain that whether this is going to pass constitutional muster or not. The fact that other states have enacted a law does not necessarily mean that it is constitutional, particularly under state constitutions, which are different. In addition, these acts have all been adopted within the last 3 years, most of them in 1983. And consequently, I think there may not have been much of an opportunity for legal challenges to arise. So we have no court cases interpreting the laws or making any statements whatsoever on their constitutionality or other legal defects. All I can say is that the further you get away from conduct which has already taken place, and the further you get away from personal observation, the riskier it is from a legal sense.
Representative Calgary had a question.
Yes, I would like to ask, under the Section C, B, line 14, for lawfully, and 1-2 of that. How would that fit in on subsistence hunting and fishing and things like that?
Representative Cotter, the subsistence regulations are all under the same title with the other fish and game laws adopted under AS-16, so those would all apply also. If a person is subsistence hunting or fishing in accordance with the law, then that's lawful.
There have been some questions on some of the, of that issue, of whether it is legal or illegal, or some person might claim when it's never been tested that he's legal. And I was just, I was just wondering if that's pretty broad, or could that be a constitutional question that might come up, or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carter, I don't think there's any constitutional problem, and I don't have any question in my mind that to say that something is done in compliance or in accordance with law is lawful. And I think that's a pretty basic definition. We're simply saying, what laws are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Larson.
Thank you. Just for a minute here, a little free legal advice. When a private landowner gives permission to an individual to hunt fish in their land, what liability do they assume? What if that hunter would shoot another? Or what if that fisherman would cause some structures?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, in our state, there is no longer the traditional distinction drawn between trespassers and invitees and licensees and so on. There is a basic standard of care that landowners are expected to observe, and it varies depending upon the extent to which the person has invited the person on, and the extent to which that the landowner is aware of dangers and things on the land which may be hidden to people coming onto the land. I think the court would also consider the fact that if the landowner were leasing or charging a fee for use of the land, that perhaps his liability may be commensurate with that. But I think that in any event, landowner is not going to be responsible for criminal conduct or conduct totally beyond the control of the landowner. And in fact, we're probably not to be liable for negligent conduct even on the part of the hunter. Thank you.
Okay, if that's all, do you have anything else then?
Let me just check this memo to make sure I haven't inadvertently skipped anything on you. Oh, one of the things I mentioned here in the memo is that the governor's veto message of last year, predecessor bill to this, raised, in addition to the, raised an objection that existing law adequately covers the problem. And as I pointed out here in the memo, existing law may well cover many instances of these kind of violations. But none of the existing laws are specifically direct to this kind of activity. None of them tell the enforcement people to look for this kind of thing. And the only time that someone's going to be charged under existing law for this kind of conduct is when the conduct happens to fit the definition of those crimes. And it was mentioned, and you can read the memo for the specifics, they mentioned disorderly conduct, harassment, assault, and criminal mischief. Those all have broad applications to other kinds of behavior. Some of the instances that are specified in the statutes conceivably would cover some case of harassment, but I, without trying to think of specific methods of harassment or obstruction, I think it's conceivable that there are some things that are going to slip through the cracks here without this kind of a bill. I'm not trying to speak in favor or against the bill. I'm just trying to say that the existing statutes do not nail down everything that this bill would.
Okay.
Yes, thank you again, Mr. Chairman. I realize Representative Gall is not here, but I do want to be able to reassure him that under this proposed draft now, that if he says, I'm going hunting, and his wife says, no, you're not, she isn't harassing him, and therefore guilty.
Sounds like it to me.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
That's all sounds like it.
There is a question that arose while I was drafting this, and again, I think Gail will address this. We had considered inserting language in the bill which would make it clear that if there is some sort of justifiable interference, whether it be by a law enforcement agent in an emergency situation, or you can stretch it out to even somebody who reasonably believed that the person was on his land and wanted to chase him off. You know, we played with that idea of whether to include language like that. I did not include it, but I think, as I say, Gail will address that issue. I think there's some merit to the question. It's just a matter of, as a matter of policy, how far you want to go. In addition, I should say that it was my impression in drafting this bill that you're concerned about activity that's happening out in the field, as opposed to something that happens before the person ever gets there. You know, you're not talking about somebody, well, I don't know, You're not talking about somebody ramming into somebody's car when they're on their way down to the boat. Although I don't know. I think there's some level or some limit here on causation, on proximate cause, as we call it. How far you're going to hold somebody accountable for hindering. And again, it's not defined in here. So, like I said, there's still going to be a certain amount of vagueness, but I think we have to assume and have some confidence and faith that people are going to interpret this law with some degree of reasonability.
Okay. We do have Gail to testify. Go ahead, Representative Glisco.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just am reading this, why the governor vetoed this bill. Now, I've seen some ridiculous things in my lifetime, but this really takes the cake. He says in here, conceivably, a person who talks too loud near a salmon stream may be subject to arrest and 30 days imprisonment under this bill, the original bill. Now, I would tell the governor, I'd tell anybody, if our wildlife protection people haven't got any more brains than that, then somebody should fire them. But that's in writing. It's a matter of record. And I say this, that we vetoed the other bill, and we should get something into law. But I would like to ask you one other question here. Supposing an individual is running a trap line, and he's pulled by another trapper, for example, that's trapped in that for years and years. If you put traps in this valley, I'm going to lift them for you. Now, you can't do anything about it until you catch him lifting them, right? Nothing can be done until you catch him springing them and lifting them and hang them up on a bush. So does this bill amply cover it? I mean, it wouldn't cover that anyway, because you have to catch the culprit himself actual, right?
Correct.
Well, you can't do anything about it until you actually catch him in the act of doing it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
But that's definitely harassment, though.
Representative Liske, the activity under this bill would have to have taken place, and you could either catch the person in the act or find evidence that it was done and bring charges later.
That's under present law. We can do that. He could do that now. Is this under present?
I don't know what the present law is. It might come under criminal mischief or tampering with property, hindering, and so on. Again, I spelled that out in the memo. If you want to go through the specific existing laws that might cover it, I can do that. But this bill would not change that, at least in the current form, the substitute. You'd still have to have... It would have to be after the fact or during the
But case. That is covered under statutes, under criminal indictments or what have you.
Whenever you tamper with somebody's property, you're running a risk of running afoul of the law.
Or a shotgun. Yeah, that's all I have.
Okay, thank you very much, Ed. Gail? For the record, your name, organization, etc.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I'm sorry I had to clear up just now with Mr. Hine what version you had in front of you to make sure I was addressing my comments to your version. I had a somewhat earlier version of this. There are some things that I would like to point out about the bill that are of concern to the prosecutors, who would be the people who would enforce the law once an arrest was made or a citation issued by Fish and Wildlife Enforcement. One is that, unlike an earlier draft, this draft does not have the language which says, in the earlier draft it said, a person having no right to do so, nor any reasonable ground to believe he has such a right, goes on to say, may not perform an act with the intent to obstruct, etc., following the language that's in there. What that basically allowed for was a person who was acting with a good faith, reasonable belief that he or she was right in the conduct that they engaged in, but turned out afterwards, in fact, to be wrong. Like, as Mr. Hines said, I thought that was my land. I don't want people hunting on my land. I saw somebody there, and I said, hey, you, this is my land. You get off. It turns out that I'm 20 feet onto my neighbor's property. I was wrong, and I shouldn't have stopped him. But under this bill, the way it's drafted now, I have just committed a crime, because there's no question that I did it on purpose and I did it to interfere with hunting and fishing. And it turns out that that person was lawfully engaged because he wasn't on my land. Maybe he was on state land, on the next hill or something. The other thing that, when we were researching this to see if this was a problem in any way, is I came across a statute, which I must confess I was not aware existed. You gentlemen might be aware of it. In the guiding statute, Title 8, 854.210, there's a whole list of unlawful acts, which it's a crime to commit, and the penalties can go up as high as 1 year and a $5,000 fine, license revoked for up to 5 years. And among those are, it is unlawful for, subsection A2, a master guide to permit the commission of a violation in the guide's sight without attempting to prevent it. In other words, a situation might come up, and I don't think it's far-fetched, it probably wouldn't happen every day, where a guide is present in land where hunting is occurring, and he sees what he believes to be a violation, whether it's over the bag limit or closed season or closed area or something, and he can either not stop it, in which case he's violated Title 8 and is looking at a year in jail, or he can stop it, and if he turns out later to be wrong, good faith, but wrong, then he's violated this statute and he's looking at 30 days and a $500 fine. Now, I'm not sure what I would advise a guide in that situation to do. Risk losing your license or risk going to jail, take your pick, hope you're not wrong. And that sort of seems not a very fair position to put him in. I think the language, the insertion of the language, which comes from the criminal mischief statutes in existing law, we took it word for word from existing law in other provisions, a person having no right to do so or no any reasonable grounds to believe he has a right, comma, may not perform an act. What that means is if he has reasonable grounds, then he is okay to do that behavior. It's got to be reasonable. He can't be, you know, off in left field on it. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is on page one, section C on line 20, there was some discussion of this earlier, of course, when Mr. Hines was here. I would strongly urge the committee to delete the word reasonably and place the words have probable cause to believe, because while you may not need probable cause to order a person to stop, because you can, you know, if I'm a cop, I can order people to do lots of things, that as long as my orders are reasonable. But then you go to the next sentence, which says the officer may arrest. There, I'm telling you this as a constitutional absolute. You cannot arrest for anything absent probable cause. You cannot arrest on reasonable suspicion. So if you're going to leave the language on line 22 in there, you've got to change it to probable cause to believe. We would recommend the deletion of the language. On line 21, it says, violated this section may order the person to desist or to leave the area. The deletion of the words, or to leave the area. In other words, the officer can tell the person to stop. But if the person has already stopped and is just in the area, like maybe he's camping there and he's interfering with the hunting, I don't think that you can defend a peace officer's order to make so that would mean you'd also have to change the language on line 22 to say an officer may arrest, or as you suggest, Mr. Chairman, cite or arrest, which would be perfectly acceptable, the person upon refusal to desist, period. And then you don't have the leave problem. I would echo Mr. Hines' concerns about the insertion of the language that was discussed earlier about demonstrating an intent to violate, especially if you leave the arrest language in, because then you're authorizing the officer to arrest a person who has not yet committed a crime, nor has he even attempted to commit the crime. But in the peace officer's mind, the man has a subjective intent to commit the crime. I don't know about the laws of some of the other states. I'm only licensed to practice in Michigan and Alaska. So I don't know what they can do in Louisiana, etc. But I know how our courts here have construed our state constitution. And time after time after time, they have construed it more, I don't know whether the word is narrower or broader, more in favor of the defendant under the state provisions and our right to privacy and that sort of thing than they have on the federal constitution. And they have said time after time, we don't care what the federal Fourth Amendment law is. Under our Fourth Amendment, you can't search for those drugs in the trunk of the car, or you can't do this, or you can't do whatever it happens to be. And I've given up second guessing the Supreme Court, Mr. Chairman, but I sincerely do believe that the addition of that language demonstrating intent to violate would be found offensive by our courts and may bring the whole statute into danger in terms of constitutional grounds. One more thing, and then I'll be glad to answer any questions. Representative Liska had asked Mr. Hines, or actually, I believe, sir, it was a comment on the governor's veto message, where you said this is stupid because a peace officer wouldn't arrest somebody for talking too loud next to a salmon stream. I'm sure you're right, and no reasonable prosecutor would bring that case even if the peace officer did arrest him. But the problem is that when you're talking about statutes on their face, and especially when you're talking in the First Amendment area, symbolic speech and, you know, expressing an objection to hunting, if that's what some people, Greenpeace or whatever, do, if you have a statute that's challenged on First Amendment grounds, what the court will do when analyzing that challenge is look at the statute on its face and say, is this statute vague or overbroad? In other words, does it cover conduct which is constitutionally protected as well as conduct which is not? And they do not look, as odd as this may sound, and I can get you the cases, they do not look at, did this guy do something that is bad and we should punish it? They go, is there some conduct which could be charged under the statute which it would be improper to charge? In other words, it would violate the First Amendment. If so, the statute is struck down because it has a chilling effect on First Amendment rights. Person doesn't know what he or she can safely do under the law. Now, you may think that's nuts, and I may have my opinion about whether that's an appropriate analysis or not, but that is the way that overbreadth and vagueness challenges are handled to the facial validity of statutes on First Amendment grounds. That helps or not. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Liska.
Thank you, Mr. Okay, Gail, on line 20 then, you brought up it on line 22, for refusal to desist, and you would want, or leave struck.
Yes, or to leave the area struck.
What about line 20 has the same thing?
You'd have to strike it on line 21, 22, and then again on line 20. Oh, I see, you have a different draft again, I'm sorry. Let's see. Yes, 20 to 21, leave the area, and also, or leave on line 21, 22.
If I may, I think that it would read like this, starting on line 19, a peace officer who has probable cause to believe that a person has violated this section may order the person to desist. The officer may arrest or cite the person upon refusal to desist.
Yeah.
Period.
And again, I would urge the inclusion of the language in A of having no right to do so nor any reasonable ground to believe.
Pardon?
Where it says on line 11, a person, and then put comma, and then say, having no right to do so, nor any reasonable ground to believe the person has such a right. That's directly out of existing law in the criminal mischief statutes. And that way, that allows...
That seems confusing to me, but run that by again.
Okay.
A person what?
A person, comma,
yeah.
Having no right to do so.
No.
Nor any reasonable ground to believe the person has such a right, comma, may not perform the act. In other words, if a person has a reasonable ground to believe that he's got a right to stop the hunting, he has not committed the crime. And again, I stress it, it have to be reasonable grounds to believe. The reason that's put in the criminal mischief statutes is that if you have somebody that's burning a barn or something, if he thinks it's his barn, it's okay for him to burn it. He hasn't committed a crime. He may owe the owner of the barn the money for the barn, but he hasn't committed a crime. Follow that?
Yep.
Ed, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, when I was originally drafting this, we had the provision in, and I took it out subsequently. Because there was some concern that it would be difficult to understand. That's not to say that it doesn't have merit. But I wanted to point out two things. One is that as a matter of drafting, it would be possible to draft this in a way that is less confusing and still achieve the same result, I think.
Okay.
Secondly, there's an issue involved here which you may want to consider in deciding whether to include this kind of language or not. And I'd like be able to address it if you would. And that is the question of who has to show that? In other words, if we insert it here in A, as she's suggesting, essentially it becomes an element of the crime. It's a fact which the prosecutor would have to allege and establish in court beyond a reasonable doubt. In essence, the prosecutor would have to show not only that the person acted with the intent to hinder or obstruct, but also could have no reasonable belief that he had a right to do it. That's one way of approaching it. Another alternative, there are at least two other alternatives, is to make such an element a defense to a crime, in which case you would say that, okay, this is the crime as we've stated it here, but if the defendant can show that he had a reasonable belief for doing it, that's a valid defense and that will defeat the charge. Thirdly, you could make it an affirmative defense, in which case the issue does not arise unless the defendant raises the issue, and then once the defendant does raise the issue, the burden shifts over to the prosecutor. Excuse me if I'm wrong on that, but maybe you can distinguish between the two for me.
If you want me to, I will.
Go ahead, Gail.
The first point, Mr. Hyman, is if you include that language, it is an element of the offense, which means the prosecutor has to prove it as his basic case. In other words, if he doesn't prove that point, he loses the case. That's probably the cleanest way to do it, although I understand that the language seems awkward. It surely does. The difference between a defense and affirmative defense, and they are different under the code, is if you have a defense, the state has to disprove the existence of that defense. An affirmative defense requires the defendant, in order to win, in other words, not be convicted, he has to prove the affirmative defense. Self-defense is a defense. We have to prove that a person, when he pulled that trigger, wasn't acting in self-defense, because if he was, he didn't commit murder. Affirmative defense is like duress or entrapment. We have proved that the guy smoked the dope or held up the bank. Then if he wants to say, I held up the bank because the guy behind me had a gun and made me hold up the bank, then he's got to prove that. Because it's a sort of a nature where only he would have his frame of mind and know that the guy was behind him and that sort of thing. If you want to do it that way, make it either a defense or an affirmative defense, I would suggest that you make it a defense. In other words, that would have pretty much the same effect as the first alternative, which is to make it an element of the crime. If the defendant raises it, then the state has to disprove it in order to win. I think that's fairer. But there are the three different options, any one of which would be legally defensible in a court, I believe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is the intent of the chair to pass this bill from committee. And if the next committee of referral is judiciary, and some of the questions that were raised on Section 1, I believe, could be better addressed in the Judiciary Committee, and as far as the wording of that, the one that was recommended by Gail. So I do think that the amendments that were suggested by Ed and Gail, and Rupe also, that we change and amend subsection C to read, a peace officer who has probable cause to believe that a person has violated this section may order the person to desist. The officer may cite or arrest the person upon refusal to desist. And if I could have a motion to adopt, first of all, I need a motion to adopt the committee substitute. What's force?
I'd make a motion to chairman to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 546.
Any objections? Hearing done, so ordered. Okay, so the committee substitute for House Bill 546 is before us. Good. Observation. Is there anyone that would like to move the Section C as was proposed? Representative Liska?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we, on Section C of the Committee Substitute for House Bill 546 Resources, to strike after the word who, strike reasonably believes, and add language has probable cause to believe, and on line 20, strike or to leave the area.
To cross out.
To strike to from the language, present yes. language. And on line 21, beginning on line 21, that we delete the last, after desist, strike or leave.
Right,
period.
And also in that, Representative Liska, did you, after the word may, did you want to insert may
oh, yes.
cite or
yes.
arrest?
Yes, also on line 21, after the word may, to change cite or arrest. In other words, change that line, just may cite or. And leave the present word arrest.
Any objections to that amendment? Hearing done, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Larson.
Yes, if this bill is to move now to the Judiciary Committee, I think maybe we should attach to it a note or something suggesting the changes that were brought up in relation to line 11.
We certainly can do that. Yes, with a letter. Transmit a letter. We'll send that along with the bill to the Judiciary. We have a motion to move.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee substitute for House Bill number 546, Resources, be moved, as amended, be moved from committee with individual recommendation.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Next bill we have before us is, thank you folks for coming down, appreciate it. We have Senate Bill 139, and... Okay, primarily in going through the Senate Bill 139, what it does is eliminate the reference to the word transporter. Dave, would you like to comment on this legislation?
Well, first of all, the Senate had meetings going on at the same time we do. This is not a priority of Senator Fahrenkamp's. If you read the little note there, legal advisors reviewed the statutes and decided that these were not being carried out. They had never been effective, and they weren't serving a public purpose to keep transporter requirements in statute. The big game guides say that it allows people for $10 to go out and get a license and act as a quasi-guide. There's being a lot of big game in the state being taken by people who aren't necessarily guides but who have transporter licenses. I think if you look back to the testimony on the Senate side, Fish and Game and Public Safety both support this. They said they've never enforced it. It's impossible to enforce and it serves no purpose. It's basically a cleanup. Mr. Harry Trigger is with us today from licensing, and he can answer some questions, but I think he may have the same viewpoint. Is it something that they've never implemented? It's impossible to implement. The original legislative idea was a good one, but it's one of those that just never really was possible to carry out.
Anyone have any questions about this legislation?
Yes, I would just, it's my understanding then that if a person flying using a airplane, or if he was using a vehicle, it'd be, you know, a four-wheel drive vehicle, all-terrain vehicle, as it stands now, it's required, but
they don't do it.
They don't enforce it. This would just remove the possibility of breaking a law that was not being enforced. So.
That's right. Mr. Chairman, the original idea was to keep track of the big game that was being transported out of the field in terms of keeping control of what was going on out there. I think folks trying to do that soon found out it was almost an impossibility. The people that were being regulated were the air taxi operators and guides were having to get an extra license, and they're bona fide. They're being controlled in other areas, so they hated it. The only people that have benefited by this are the people that have found a way to abuse our big game resources in the state, and that's why, literally, the Sportsman's Council and the APHA and about anybody involved in hunting and fishing does, in fact, support this this concept. It's one of those rare ones.
Yeah, I'd make a motion that
Senate Bill 139.
Yeah.
With, individual recommendation. There is a motion. There is objection.
I object for one reason. I'd like to ask Dave, how does this interfere now with the air taxi operator taking a group of hunters out, the last hunters now?
Well, if they're a bona fide air taxi operator, they have to, number one, they're required to carry a certain amount of insurance, and they are controlled by us, by FAA regulations, okay, for their activity. But what happens is a person who just owns an airplane and pays $10 and gets his transporter license, he is legal to be out there for transporting game. So he falls in between the legal air taxi operator and the guide, and that's the problem area.
He's legal to be if he transports his own game and not somebody else's.
That's somebody else's too.
Under the
you see the
present law today.
That's right. That's
right. Yeah. I remember
that. Hearing, no more objections. Hearing done. House Bill 139 has passed. Resources is adjourned.
You do good work.
Not really. We could have a lot longer than that. One.
I'm sorry for being late. I was being.